I'm an alcoholic. My name is Casey Hayes.
Casey.
My sobriety date is February 11th, 1989. And I'm a member of the Lucky Ones group in Corpus Christi, Texas. In case you missed it earlier, it's a closed big book and closed 12 and 12 meeting. We do closed and literature. That's all we do. Come early and have some good fellowship. I was thinking of my first sponsor. He used to say that he was just like the donkey that carried Jesus into Jerusalem. He was just the ass carrying the message, you know. And there's a lot of asses in here. Sorry. I don't know. I like this. It's very relaxing to me. You know, I'm not intimidated by being around 200 men. I'm not intimidated by people from different parts of the country. I'm not intimidated by that anymore. When I entered Alcoholics Anonymous, I was scared. I didn't fit in. I knew you weren't going to like me. I knew it wasn't going to work. I knew you were putting on a front. And I was wrong. I was wrong. I was born and got sober, so I was reborn, how about that, in Indianapolis, Indiana. And I have great parents, you know. I can say today they've passed on. I was able to be there for them when they were sick and dying and be there for their last minute, you know, last moments, and take care of them before and after and eulogize them. And you know, I consider I could just bookended my amends with them. I lived it for the rest of their life until they passed away. And I think of them every day. You know, I've outlived four sponsors. And I think of them every day. They're in my gratitude prayers in the morning. Those men never relapsed. Willard's my sponsor now. He's never relapsed. These men that passed away before me, they died with permanent sobriety, one-chip wonders. And I learned that I don't have to take a drink, that relapse is not a part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really what happens if I don't work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not, and I relapsed. I was one who fought Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I grew up, I've got three older brothers, again, like a very loving family. My father was probably one of us. I won't brand him an alcoholic, but I did check a few boxes on the pamphlet one time, and he matched up to be probably one of us. But, you know, in my inventory process, I was able to determine that my father did the best he could. And as I got to know that man, I found out that he grew up in conditions that was unacceptable. And he really did the best he could. And my mother was a saint to me. And she saved my life. She was a member of Al-Anon. She helped me find Alcoholics Anonymous by revoking my bail and throwing me back in jail. Because that's what Al-Anons do. Or at least the ones in her life. Yeah. And but, you know, I grew up in this family. And I have to say that we had everything we wanted. We never went without food. We never had money, but we never went without food. We always had clothes. We always went on a vacation. It was to a state park. We never went to Disney, but we always went somewhere. My parents always supported us if we wanted to be in sports or music or scouts. I mean, they found the ways and means to support us. They would show up, you know. But we were really latchkey kids. We kind of had to grow up on our own. And I grew up idolizing my father, you know, at that little age where you still call him daddy. You know, I just remember he would be gone before the sun was up, and he wouldn't come home until after the sun went down. And he was an engineer at this company, and he did international sales and union arbitrations. He spent lots of time away providing for our family, and I just idolized him, you know. And then on Saturday, we would all go out and do, you know, the Hayes boys would all do the stuff with Dad. We would look under the hood of the cars. You know, we would mow and rake. And, you know, it was just, you know, the Hayes family. Mom was inside, you know. But, you know, that was just part of how I grew up. And I remember my first drink. I know my first drink. I don't know the exact day, but it was about 2 weeks after I graduated from second grade. So I was about 8. And I remember vividly asking my father, can I have a drink? He was drinking a cold beer on the in the backyard, reading one of those Louis L'Amour Westerns. You know, he worked all weekend getting things ready. And I just remember him just letting me hold that beer with both hands, and it was just cold, and your nose tickles, and it tastes like somebody poured water in a boot or something. It just was nasty. But I got to tell you, I just felt like my father. That drink changed me. Like, I was just like my dad, you know. And I'm not saying it changed me, like, in the doctor's opinion, but I felt just like my father. And I just adored him. And what was interesting is my drinking, I ended up living in terror of him and eventually wanted to kill him. You know, I mean, it got down to brawls in our household. You know, but that was just what happens when I drink alcohol. You know, he had his own problems. But, you know, that was the first experience I ever had with alcohol. And I have to say, though, you know, we talk at that 5 percenters meeting. You know, I've been scared since I can remember. I've been in fear since I can remember. I just never felt like I fit in. And I'm sure somebody in this room felt the same way. You know, I always worried about what you thought of me. I never measured up much. Like I said before, I couldn't function well with reading and writing and stuff, so I would compensate in other ways. You know, and for me, I just, I compensated by really beginning to learn to how to tear people down. You know, I would be destructive in our household, and that would get the attention that I needed. And sadly, it was the wrong kind of attention. But for me, you know, I just need to get to the point to get to AA, because we need to get me sober. But so from about the second grade to the fifth grade was what my sponsor kind of figured out was my social drinking. And my social drinking consisted of my father would come home, and he would pour up about 3 fingers of whiskey in a glass, throw a few cubes of ice on there, a splash of soda. He'd grab the daily paper, and he'd sit in the recliner, and he'd begin to smoke cigarettes and drink his whiskey and read the paper. And I used to just hover kind of outside of his eyesight. And whenever he would go to the bathroom, you know, alcohol, right, I would sneak around the corner, and I would just puff, puff, puff on that cigarette, and then I would just drink, drink, drink his liquor. And I would then go hide around the corner, and he would do about 3 of those drinks. So by the time supper came around, he was feeling smooth, and I was feeling smooth. And that's all I needed to feel. I just wanted to feel smooth. I didn't want to feel anything, even at a young age. And that went on for several years. So that's kind of my drinking career I guess, the temperate drinker. One of the things that I have to say is that an event happened in my life where I needed to take a drink. I went from the feeling I liked the way it felt to I need to drink so I don't feel. And I remember that vividly. And I'm still a young kid at this age. And I remember telling my best friend, I need to get drunk. I was devastated what happened to me. And I proceeded to drink from that point on to no longer feel, to escape. And that's when it just took over for me. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My last drink was beer. And I came in because I drank all weekend and couldn't get drunk. And it scared me. Like, that was my last hope was liquor, and it betrayed me, you know, and that's how I came to AA. But through this young drinking career, it's not like you're going to take your big wheel or your bicycle to the liquor store and order a fifth. I had to figure out ways and means to get more, And as a youth, I became a cat burglar with my best friend. You remember the aerial antennas that went up the side of the houses, right? I'm not dumb. I just was slow. And we realized nobody locks the second story window. Like, who would? And we knew all of our alcoholics in our neighborhood on the city block, and we knew who had what. And we would just, one of us would shimmy up this TV aerial antenna and slide open the window and go downstairs and steal a bottle from the liquor cabinet and lock the door as you left. And that's how we got our liquor as kids, really. We stole from our parents more liquor. And so that's how I got drunk. And I would do that pretty much every school night until I got to the junior high age. And at that point, I lived two blocks from the school. And I would begin the morning drink. And I remember I didn't understand what that was when I talked to Bert, is the morning drink. It wasn't madness yet, but I knew I didn't fit in at school, and I knew by this time alcohol took away that fear, and it made me feel acceptable. And so by the time I was in junior high, I was already drinking before I went to school, and at lunchtime you could walk two blocks back home and have some more drinks. And this proceeded to cause me lots of problems academically. Later, it became an issue where the law was being involved, and I kept getting arrested at school. Now, having to say that, at the same time, I'm excelling at everything I want to do. You know, I'm getting all the letters, you know, you're an athlete, or I learned how to memorize in school, and I would just memorize these lectures, and then I would pass with flying colors, but I still couldn't read. You know, and so I was excelling in one sense, but on the other side, alcohol had already caused me lots of problems. At this age, you know, a young teenage boy and his father usually don't get along. And this is when things would get ugly in our house. After I got sober, my mother used to ask, "Why do you keep going to your father's house?" I said, "Because I'm not mad at him anymore." You know, and she said, "But you used to be his favorite punching bag." You know, and I go, "Yeah, that's right." Like, what kind of a father would just haul off and punch their son? But what I was dealing with was another alcoholic, I think. And when I'm a smart-mouthed kid and he's an overbearing father, we're going to have conflict in the house. And that lasted for a couple years until I went to, I was supposed to go to court. And I told my father, "Hey, I got to tell you, tomorrow we got to go to court." I didn't tell him why. And on the day of court, I promised myself I was not going to take a drink that morning. I wasn't going to drink. I was going to make it to lunchtime. I was going to go to court for this charge. I was going to go back home, and I was going to drink. And you could have put my hand on the Holy Bible, and I would have swore to you, I am not going to take a drink this morning. And what happens? By lunchtime, I'm drunk, and I've set the house on fire, and I have to go to court in about an hour. And that was just how it was in our household, just these crazy things that happened over and over and over. And I look back at my parents, they tolerated so much unacceptable behavior from me. What happened is the arresting officer was the nephew of the judge. So the charge was guilty, kind of out of the gate. I wasn't going to win that. And my neighbor was the state's attorney, and he was ready to hang me high. And I have to say that Alcoholics Anonymous did their job. You did your job. You see, the public information in cooperation with professional communities spoke to the judge and the state's attorney. The correctional facilities people spoke to Sheriff Dan Crumrin, where I was locked up in the jail. You know, you all did your job, and for some reason, it was a charge, it doesn't matter what, but they, you know, it was a 20-year charge. And I remember the judge saying, "You're guilty, but we need to give you a chance. The jail is not where you need to be. You need somewhere else." And he said, "If you agree, we'll send you in a secured kind of a unit place away, and we'll deal with issues." And of course, you know, I'm amenable to that. And they take me to this facility and lock me away. and I'm introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's just like that prison that I went to early on. The men in there were tough, and they wouldn't let any of us talk because we knew nothing about sobriety. And I don't know if I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous or fell in love with the respect that these men had from all of these people. Like, they had the respect of all these people, and I'm new. And I get out of this institution, and within about an hour, I start drinking again. You know what? And what I realized is just because I want to quit drinking doesn't mean I'm going to quit drinking. You know, the old adage, you know when you got diarrhea and doing something about it's two different things. And for me, I knew I had a drinking problem, but I didn't want to do anything about it. So Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't that appealing to me. For me, I kept drinking for another 9 months and went through the hospital system as I was having health issues and again kind of put away in the place where Alcoholics Anonymous was there. And this time I found a man who was going to be my sponsor. He was this old man. He's an old World War II sergeant, got sober in the late 50s. And he was just the kind old man. And he was a family friend. I just didn't know. You know, and I remember asking Bert, will you be my sponsor? And he says, kid, we'll talk. Let's talk. And I get out, and I immediately go to all the cool hip groups, all the open discussion meetings. I was looking for a job. I was looking for a couple dates. I was looking for everything else but sobriety. But he was going to these closed literature meetings, you know. And I remember going to all these meetings, like 7 days a week. I'm going to all the dances. I'm going to all the functions. I'm checking all the boxes. I'm doing all the AA stuff, right? I'm doing all the AA stuff. And I go to a meeting, and I left the meeting, and within about 15 minutes, I found myself drinking again. Again, if you would have asked me, I was chairing the meeting, if you're going to take a drink tonight, are you? I could have put my hand on the Bible and swore, I am not going to take a drink tonight. I am convinced I'm okay today. And you know, that mental blank spot it talks about. You know, I'm very scared of that. I'm very scared of that. You see, because that relationship with God is that only thing that's going to prevent that from my life. So when I tried to do AA, I tried to do it, I didn't put my full faith and effort into getting sober, you know. But I was doing all the stuff that people told me to do. Everything they told me to do, I did. And what do? I continued to drink for 9 months, and I contacted my sponsor, and I said, I want to get sober again, and can we go to treatment? And he said, no. He told me flat out, no, we'll be over. And him and another old-timer came over, and he said, you've already been to treatment. You're not going to learn anything new in treatment. We're going to do this the AA way. And I just remember laying in this old shooting gallery apartment. You know, the stomach is doing somersaults, sweat's coming out of every pore. You know, the body does funny things when you detox off of alcohol. And they just put the touch on me for about 3 days. And I remember the last day when they said, you're kind of clear. I remember Bert asked me, he says, Casey, remember how you feel. You know, remember how you smell, you know. And from that moment on, I have not had a drink since. I literally did everything he wanted me to do, with the exception of going to the AA meetings that he went to. You see, I still wanted to have alcoholic behavior without the consequences of drinking. And I just realized I couldn't do that anymore. And so I eventually went to these meetings with this man. And I don't know. Really what happened was he called me a fake and a phony and told me I was going to die drunk. And he would just put his hand on my shoulder and say, kid, you need to quit fighting it. You know, I was fighting everything. I was fighting the format of the meetings. Like I said, I was crazy. I was fighting everything. I remember his son, Grumpy, was talking about having a cookout like they do on Wednesday. And I'm asking him, I said, well, where is it and so I can be there? And he says, you're not invited. You're not invited. And I'm like, well, why? And he says, because your behavior is unacceptable. We don't want it around our spouses or our children, you know? I said, wow, you guys are serious. I began to conform in Alcoholics Anonymous pretty quick because, one, because I wanted to hang out with you. I wanted to be with you. I wanted to go where you went to. I found out real quick I could not curse. I could be respectful to your children and your wife. I could not tear up your stuff. You know, I could do all kinds of stuff. I just didn't want to do it. Well, what they showed me was an Alcoholics Anonymous that I could have. So I literally set out on intentional sobriety with this man. And we would just go everywhere. We did a lot of meetings together. He would put me kind of in this old club in Terre Haute, and then we'd later go to Indianapolis to another club. And he would introduce me to all these old-timers, you know. And I just love storytellers in AA. And I would just sit and listen to these stories. And they would let me go on 12-step calls with them. I couldn't talk to anybody. They wouldn't let me do that part. But I could do the, you know, make the coffee, clean the kitchen, gather the medicine in case they got to go to the hospital stuff. And but just to be in a house sometimes doing a 12-step call just would make the chills go up my arm, because you just hear this poor guy, this poor person in the room sometimes just howling out, you know. Just detoxing is a horrible thing. And I'm grateful I don't ever have to do that again if I don't want to. Like I said, I was with this man, and I was going to go become a veterinarian. I have no idea why I wanted to be a veterinarian, but the Purdue University said you have a 0.7 GPA, which was an F plus. And they said that you could get straight A's for 10 years and we wouldn't let you in. And I remember being asked, what do you want to do when you grow up, you know? And I told him, and he says, well, you can't do that in Indiana. You got to go somewhere else. And what I love about old-timers in AA, they know everybody everywhere. They just know everybody everywhere. And I figured out where I wanted to go. It was in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And Bert goes, oh, I know this guy. Yeah. And next thing you know, I'm getting meeting schedules and apartment finders mailed to me. I'm getting phone calls from Darwin and his wife Jerry, and we can't wait to see you. And I take my wife to South Carolina, and he's the second person I met in AA, you know. And they had this little sign over the door that said, you're a stranger here but once. And it was the same kind of old-fashioned AA that I was raised with in the Midwest I found in South Carolina. And they had all these closed meetings. They had probably 70-80% of the meetings were all closed. Even most of the beginners' meetings were closed. Because Alcoholics Anonymous was for alcoholics. We have enough open meetings for people who are curious. And I found my people. I found my home in South Carolina. And, you know, one of the things I didn't tell you is that morning watch was so important to me. You know, Bert would say, you know, do whatever you're going to do with your 24-hour day book and then come on over, you know. And for 9 months, Monday through Friday, I would go over to his office and we would have the morning watch. And, you know, that 12-step self-evaluation, meditation, and prayer, when properly interwoven, is an unshakable foundation for life. And he showed me what they did. And sometimes there would be another old-timer or two. They'd have coffee and they'd share in that time. And I kind of adopted something similar to that to myself. And that was real important to me. And what happened is I'll tell you that I thought I was going to be just fine in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm going to meetings now, I have a good plan, I have a good sponsor, I'm doing the deal. What happened with me is at 7 years sober, my morning watch stopped. At 7 years sober, 7 years and 6 months sober, that damnable urge to drink hit me. And it was like Mike Tyson did a roundhouse punch and hit me. And I started crying. I was like bawling, like crying, like, God, please, you know, I don't make fun of foxhole religion. I do not make fun of foxhole religion. I was like begging God, please God, don't let me drink. Please God, don't let me drink. I knew if I left the house, I knew if I walked out that front door, I'm getting drunk. I knew it like I know y'all are in this room with me. But the AA training was just all of a sudden my mind went absolutely quiet. You know, I'm begging God and it went quiet. And it was like, call your sponsor, right? Call your sponsor. Just call your sponsor. And I remember calling my sponsor. And I'm gathering, you know, trying to sound, you know, kind of cool on the phone. And he's like, hey, what's going on? I said, hey, we need to talk. And he said, I'm getting ready to do a fifth step. And I'm like, I can't wait that long. And he's like, what's the matter? And I says, we need to talk. He says, meet me halfway. You know, and he met me at this Burger King, of all places, where they have the kids' play area, so there's kids playing, and I'm crying, trying to look cool with my sunglasses on, tears going down my face, and he's like, take off your glasses. Take off your glasses. You know, like, be a man. Cry. Cry like a man. What's the matter with you? You know, and in about 5 minutes, this man diagnosed my problem. You see, I had started the same old habit. I kept going to the meetings, and I was sponsoring people, and I'd start doing work service work in my group, and I was doing all the functions, and I was going to the inner group, and I was, you know, checking all the boxes. But you see, I didn't have a prayer life. My prayer life dwindled down to minutes. Well, I'll do it in the car until the next stoplight. I'll meditate over here when it, you know, that's a 2-minute light. I'll meditate then. You know, we had a little routine that was working really good. And what happened is I didn't see that slide that took place. I have a certain amount of time I kind of devote to that. And it slowly, week after week, month after month, got a little bit shorter, a little bit shorter, a little bit shorter. Maybe I forget to do any prayers today. It got shorter and shorter and shorter until it was next to nothing. Next to nothing. And I promised God, I promised my sponsor, and I promised myself, I'm not going to let up on my sober routine ever again, ever again. And I can tell you today that my wife, when she sees the den door closed, unless there's fire, nobody opens the door. We know how important that is to me. So once I righted my ship, I wanted to, I don't know if anybody else had an issue with God's people in the church. I got over my resentment with God. I thought the church was lovely, but some of his creatures were kind of troubling for me. But I had a moment in my sobriety where I remembered my conversion experience. You know, it's kind of like delayed. I had a conversion experience in my first year of sobriety that I had completely forgotten about, and it just came to me like it was yesterday. And for me, my conversion experience was real simple. I couldn't sleep. My alcoholism called me a piece of crap, says it wasn't going to matter. You didn't really like me. AA didn't work. You were a bunch of punks and suckers, and this isn't going to work, so why do it, you know? And I told Bert this, and he said, well, Casey, why don't you read the personal stories, you know, at nighttime, because that's about 2 or 3 when that would come on me. And he said, either you'll find your story or you'll fall asleep. It's a win-win, right? And I remember doing that for several nights, and I remember then I read this story. It's the story, He Thought He Could Drink Like a Gentleman, by Abby G., the alcoholic who gave us the principle of spirit of rotation. And in Abby's story, his sponsor, Clarence S., is just putting the business on him, chasing him around everywhere, going to the bars with him, trying to, you know, put the touch on him. And he finally said, I'm just going to give him his due. And he says, he took me to see Bill Wilson. And he said, I remember challenging Bill, what was it that made AA work so many wonders? And in the story, there's a picture that's above the fireplace mantle, and Bill points to it and says, there it is. And it was a picture of Gethsemane. And I understood the significance of Gethsemane from my childhood faith. And it just was like I had a conversion experience. It was like as if I was completely cloaked and protected. I knew I would never, ever, ever be able to comprehend or understand the pain, suffering, and agony of Gethsemane. and that whatever I was going to go through in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to be okay. Like, it's going to be okay. Like, it was fixed. And that's why I just did what this man told me to do, because everything is great. Well, you know, about 8 years later, I have this epiphany, like, I want to go back to church. I missed church. Church was the only safe place that I didn't get hit. Church was the only safe place that I loved the way it made me feel. I felt safe there. Everybody was nice to me at church. I loved the music. I had a great preacher. I loved Reverend Beasley. He was a good man. He knew what was happening in our house. Yeah, he probably had a lot of parishioners that had the same problem. And every time he'd talk to me, he'd get on his knee and get eye level with me, you know. And I told my sponsor, I said, I think I want to go back to church. And he said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't do drive-bys. You're going to have to pick one and go every Sunday for a month and tell me, kind of report back to me what you heard, saw, and felt, right? And I did that. And I don't know why I'm telling you this, but it's important for me. You know, I told my wife, I said, I'm going back. Well, she had a similar experience, but she wasn't going to go back. And she's like, do not make me go to church with you. And I didn't. And so I proceed to continue in my AA life. Work's good. My relationship with my wife is good. Everything is good. And about 2.5 years later, my wife says, are you going to go to church tomorrow? And I go, yeah. And she says, I want to come. And I've been praying about that for 2.5 years, that God softened her heart. You know, and I took her to whichever one that she wanted to go to. And I remember the second hymn, I look at my wife and she's crying, like she's home again, right? And that's how I feel when I walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, it's like, I can breathe. I'm home again. You know, you guys understand me. You know, I'm one of the bunch. You know, I'm one of the crowd again. You know, and that was important for me because I knew all along it was important to my wife. And I was able to go ahead and start that process with my wife. And that's been really important to me in my sobriety. And the reason why I want to say that is because a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've had people tell me, you don't need to do that. You know, Dr. Bob was a great proponent. If you have a faith, support it. Right? And so that's been important in my sobriety life, and I just want to give credit to where credit's due. Alcoholics Anonymous and God saved my life, and I'm able to go back to church now and not judge them so harshly, you know. For me, I sponsored the way my sponsor sponsored me. He never pushed me. He never asked me to do anything he didn't do himself. We would sit and read the book. He sat and read the book to me because I couldn't read real well. Well, I'd read to the guys or they read to me, whatever they want to do. But we read at whatever pace they want to read. We do whatever they want to do at whatever pace they want to do it. Because that's just what was done with me. And I think one of the things that was most important to me was the habit of going to these closed meetings, you know. I went to lots and lots and lots of closed meetings. Matter of fact, that's all I exclusively go to now is closed meetings. And they were all these literature meetings. And I would go to the meetings where there are men and women. I didn't go to stag meetings. I went to men and women meetings. And I would hear the experiences of the women alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was just as important to hear their take on AA as it was the men. And So I've always went and did that. And matter of fact, there's lots of women in AA that I consider my heroes. They have stellar AA. They have wonderful marriages. And that's important to me. I think service work has been just a natural progression in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was made a coffee or the secretary treasurer. The next thing they do is like, well, would you like to be, what was it they had me do now? Oh, they made me the alternate treasurer next. How in the world do you go from treasurer to alternate treasurer? I don't know. But it was always not because it was good for my sobriety. It was always because I was willing to do it. You know, a lot of times we just have to ask people, are you willing to do this? And this is what we expect of you. You know, I got that phone call on Thanksgiving Day of 1998 when you know, my mom called, and she always referred to Bert as mine. You know, that's your sponsor. And she just called, and she says, "Casey, I want to let you know," she's, you know, crying. She says, "Your Bert's dead," you know. And it was the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous I cried, like, really cried. Like, this man, I cried more when that man died than my father died. Because he was the guy who taught me everything what it means to be a man, you know, because he was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. How to be a great husband. How to go to a job and not steal time. You know what I mean? Sit on the chair and steal time. He made me accountable for a lot of things we heard earlier, being accountable for things. And when this man died, it just ripped my heart out. And I needed to get a new sponsor, and I knew exactly where to go and what to do. And for me, I've always just had a sponsor. I think it's really important to have one. It's not a requirement in Alcoholics Anonymous to have a sponsor. It's not a requirement to have a home group, but I think the men who stay sober and have kind of that long-term sobriety have sponsors and have home groups. The time came for me to move yet again, and it was to Texas. I have to say that since I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've never had to look for a job. It was somebody always headhunted me or sought me out and said, "Would you like to come here? Would you like to do this?" Because I was employable again. I was able to be a good employee, a loyal employee. I understood what that meant. And I get a phone call. They said, "Would you move to Texas?" And I said, "Sure." No questions asked. I just said, "Sure." I knew the man. He said, "I'll make it worth your while." He knew I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "Come on down." And so I left after 20 years in South Carolina to Texas, South Texas. And I have to say my first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous in Texas was not good. I remember talking to Jay and George and Darwin and them, and they kept talking about all these, "Oh, you're going to love Texas," and "Wino Joe." They knew all these old timers in Texas. And I remember I flew into Corpus Christi, and I'm not going to say the group, but I go to a group, and the first thing I hear in this meeting is somebody talking about coming off of heroin. And then I remember in the corner somebody talking about their mental health issues and bipolar issues. And they didn't pass the seven tradition basket. They said, "Well, if you feel like you want to contribute, we'll leave a basket up here." And I remember going back to South Carolina and saying, "Please don't make me go. Like, I can't do Texas AA." And I remember Marie E. says, "Honey, God wants you in Texas, so you're going to Texas." I guess the AAs in South Carolina had already made their mind up. And I moved to Texas, and I have to confess today to you that I was absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong. If I would have judged Texas AA on that one meeting, I would have sold you all short. It took me a little bit, and I found a wonderful group that did closed meetings, big book meetings. They were very active in sponsorship. They liked to be active in service work. They liked to go to the treatment center. They liked to go to the prisons. And I just felt it was like an old pair of shoes. They just slid right in. It wasn't a problem. The only real problem that came about of moving to Texas is I accidentally went to the Lucky Ones group. And I remember talking to my sponsor at the time, the guy I had, and I says, I got to leave. Like, it's like a divorce almost. Like, I got to leave this group. It's a great group, but I got to go. And he said, "You're going to leave the group like an AA member is. You're going to go in, you're going to grab your membership card out of the box, and you're not going to make a scene, and you're going to thank everybody like you always do, and you're going to leave, and you're going to go to your new home group and ask, 'Can I be a member of this group?'" And that's what I did. While I've been in Texas, I continue to be active in service in whatever way possible. And I still make coffee at my home group. I'm always there an hour early, and the coffee's made. People don't show up early anymore, but it's ready if you want to show up. For me, Alcoholics Anonymous repaired every relationship I had. Every single relationship I had is completely repaired. I have not had a bad amend in AA. I've just not had bad amend. I just haven't had any of that. That's not my experience. I've done everything, every single thing that a sponsor has suggested or asked of me. I found a group of men that I try to travel with as much as possible. One of my fondest memories in Texas is there's a convention in Houston, but I drive to San Antonio to go to Mike's. We jump in his truck to drive to Austin, over to Willard's, to jump into his car to go down to Elgin, to go pick up Steve to drive to Houston. Now, I could have been to Houston 5 hours ago, but I knew the value of windshield time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not going to miss this opportunity. And that's a fond memory because we went everywhere together. We ate everywhere together. If one person had to pee, we all went to pee. If one person was thirsty, we all were thirsty. And it's just like family, right? I'm all in. You know, the things that I experienced in my sobriety allowed me to come to the point to where I could take care of my parents like I started off with. You know, I got the phone call that my father, that Christmas my father tried to quit drinking. I've never known him not to drink liquor. He just always drank. He tried drinking some O'Doul's for a couple days. And I just remember at Christmas time he started getting the shakes. And I said, Dad, it's okay. You know, you can make a drink. It's okay. You know, and he made his drink, and that went away. But I think that's his attempt. He tried. And I get the phone call that, you know, your father has had a massive heart attack and a stroke. And during the hospitalization, we've also found brain cancer and lung cancer and congestive heart failure, and this is wrong. And I just remember saying, well, what's right? You know, what isn't broken on this man? And I was able to, for 8 months, fly home every month and spend a week with him and take care of their needs for my stepmom and my dad. And he shared more with me about his life in those last 8 months of his life. I think he knew it was time that God was going to call him home. And he just availed to me all of those things that happened and all those fears that he had. And he was able to tell me he was proud of me. And I said, you know, Dad, I'm grateful for you. And I was able to tell him honestly, you know, I'm glad you're my father. I'm glad we had troubles. Yes, we had troubles. But I'm glad you're my father. I learned a great worth ethic from him. And he was a great provider. And was able to be there for his last breath, hold his hand, call his time of death. And it was absolutely amazing because that was the town that I got sober in. And my sponsor had already died, like I said, but his son was still alive. And all these AAs, a lot of them I didn't even know. There must have been 25 or 30 men came to my father's funeral. And it's kind of like the AA section. And everybody knew they were Bert and Grumpy's guys. And it's like AA showed up. And they just kind of took care of me. They just showed up to take me to meetings. They said, let's go talk. Let's go to the coffee place. Let's hang out. They would bring food to the house. They were the ones who came to my parents' house and built the wooden ramp and did the wiring for the electricity, for the lights, and then went and built stoops and all this stuff. That's just what they did. They came and mowed my father and mother's lawn every week. These are just AA guys. That's just what they did. They just did. And I just fell in love with AA all over again. And, you know, the last couple of years, I'd lost about 8 family members. And my mother was one of those people. And, you know, she was in Al-Anon since 1965. And like I said, she was the one that threw me back in jail for my own good. And I remember in the hospital, we were just talking. We were just talking, right? And I'm just going to tell you because I got to tell you, you know. And she's like, I want to let you know my favorite color is blue. That your grandfather worked at U.S. Steel. My favorite car I never owned was a powder blue Mercedes. I loved growing up watching the Bowery Boys. She was just telling me all these little, simple, intimate details I would have never asked. It's like she knew I probably needed this information later. And I remember she just, actually I was on the phone with Willard. It's Tuesday, Willard Day. And I get the news that I have to make the decision. And I remember, I was crying, I don't know if he knew, I was crying on the phone trying to do what we do and then talk to the doctors and after that. And I went in and told my mom, I said, you know, Mom, we need to make a decision. And she says, I trust you, you know, I trust you. And the greatest thing happened is I just remember she grabbed my face, and said, I love you very much. And it was okay at that moment. You know, to say at midnight, pull the cord. You know. I had a 34-year amend with that woman. It was a pain I'd never experienced. Ever. That's the power of AA in my life. I desperately needed to hear that she loved me. And I was able to say, it's time. And she said, what are you doing? And I said, well, we're going to give the last year medicine. We're getting your discharge papers together. And you're going to go home. God, what a joy. Guess who showed up at the funeral? AA. Droves and droves and droves of AA showed up. They knew I was dying. I wasn't going to drink. I was hurting. Like I never hurt before. And AA's always been there for me. Always been there for me. And I hope I never ever take you for granted. I hope I never take the steps for granted for sure. And most importantly, I hope I never give up on that sober routine of talking to God every day. And I'm a blessed man. And I think we are the lucky ones, right? Because we haven't taken that drink. And that's all I got. Thank you.